and drop that shit for these fuck niggas.
From theunts.com, this is the Unts Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunts.com. Hello and welcome to the Unts Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. Today we've got a very special hour-long episode for you. It's been 3 years now since the launch of theunts.com, and I wanted to do something special for the fans who make this site possible. We love telling you about the dance music events in your town and breaking new artists who go on to do unbelievable work. Without the support of you guys, the Unts doesn't exist. So from all of us here, we thank you so very much. We're celebrating the Unts' third anniversary at 1015 Folsom in San Francisco this Friday, December 21st, with the help of Euphonic Conceptions, Antenna, and headliners Freak Nasty, Sleepyhead, Symbionic, Akara, and more. One of the acts helping us ring in the end of the world, or beginning, or whatever it's going to be, is one of our favorite artists, Wicket the Instigator. Andrew Owsley has been taking the dance music world by storm from his home base in Nashville, Tennessee. This guy can produce any kind of track, from dubstep to trap to moombahtone, but his specialty is mashups, and they go viral instantly. We're going to hear all about Wicket and his brand new A Very Wicket Christmas mini mix, which is up for free download now, along with so much more here in a minute. This is one incredible guy, and we're thrilled to have him on the show, so stay tuned. We had you on the first live Unts podcast from summer camp this past May, and you were such a source of information and have such a great perspective. So thank you so much for coming back on the show for a little one-on-one session.
You are welcome.
I can only imagine you wish 2012 would last forever, because this has been just an incredible year for you. Really, in the year since you dropped Grindhouse Bastards, you've absolutely blown up. I wonder how you've been charting your own growth over the past 12 months. Do you just see the shows getting bigger and the time slots getting better? Do you start to see more fans out at shows, especially in places where you haven't even been before?
Well, I mean, as happy as I am for all the progress, you know, that's been made and all the hard work that is definitely paying off, there definitely isn't like a sense of like champagne popping with me. It's like I still want to progress. I'm still, you know, anytime I feel like I advance maybe to a next stage or next tier, I still feel like I'm not there yet, you know. So to me, it's like I still feel far away from where I'm trying to be. So it is like I said, as happy and as positive as I feel towards the progress, I still feel like really hungry and really trying to get where I'm going. You know, it's very exciting, but at the same time, I always feel like I'm not where I'm trying to be. I always feel like I haven't produced the song I'm trying to produce. Like I always feel like I'm trying to get somewhere, and I still feel like I'm trying to get somewhere. And I hope that doesn't come off negative, because it's puts hopefully. That's kind of how I stay. That's how I kind of keep the fire lit. Like I never want to kind of kick back and prop my feet up and be like, oh, this is great, you know, because I'm still just trying to. I want more. Like I want it all. I want, you know, I want statues and the cover of Rolling Stone.
I mean, it makes sense. That's an answer a true artist would give. You're never quite happy with, you know, where you are production-wise or ability to get what you want done in the industry. So is there any way you can tell me what success looks like besides the statues and the cover of Rolling Stone? Is it you can make any sort of album you want, you can work with anybody you want, you've got your own fans that will always come out and see you and buy your records and all that? Is that kind of what success looks like to you?
Well, you know, it's like, I think success to me is maybe more a feeling of security and longevity. It's like, I'm very happy to be where I am right now, but I don't, It's not like I have a big 401k sitting in front of me or anything. It's like my future still feels like a question mark, basically. And there's definitely another tier I'm trying to get to, another level where I'm trying to get to, where I know, you know, I want to get to the point to where anywhere I go in the world, I'm confident that I'm just could sell thousands of tickets. And I'm definitely, you know, not at that point right now. Like I do well in a lot of markets, you know. I just want to get to that level to where I feel like, okay, like my future is secure, almost in kind of like a, you know, almost in kind of like an adult responsibility kind of sense of, you know, okay, like this is definitely what I'm going to get to do for just years and years and forever for the rest of my life. Like right now, I feel like things are going really, really great right now. And it's like, if I can get them to go a little better, if we can progress more, then I think I'll feel a little bit more like, okay, I'm definitely going to be like a career lifelong musician, you know?
You're looking to get DJ tenure.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely a level, you know, I'm trying to get to. It's not just fame and money. It's like security. It's like, okay, we're good here. We're good. We're definitely going to get to do this for a long time. And so, long story short, I feel like things are going great, but I still kind of feel like I'm in like fingers crossed mode. You know what I mean?
Hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirty and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? A shadow in the city, hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirty and gritty, bend down, isn't it a pity, doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city.
Here it is, a groove slightly transformed, just a bit of a break from the norm. Just a little something to break the monotony of all that hardcore dance that has gotten to be a little bit out of control. It's cool to dance, but what about a groove that soothes and moves romance? Give me a soft, subtle mix, and if it ain't broke, then don't try to fix it. And think of the summers of the past, adjust the bass and let the Alpine blast. Pop in my CD and let me run a rhyme, and put your car on cruise and lay back, cause it's summertime.
Hot Summer, The Loving Spoonful, The Fresh Prince, and a very jazzy DJ by the name of Jeff. This is the Unz Podcast.
At the same time, you are one of those truly viral artists producing out there today, and you know, in this internet age, I can't think of anyone else who does it better. Whenever you drop a new remix or mashup, it's going to hit Hype Machine. You're going to rack up tens of thousands of listens in the first couple of hours on SoundCloud. What is the secret to that viral success? Unless, of course, you want to keep it a secret.
There isn't a secret. I've been a slow build, you know. I've never had overnight change, or, you know, to where I woke up one day and my whole entire world was different. It's been a slow build, and I've been putting out, you know, content on SoundCloud for a couple years now and building up the fan base. One thing I always was doing is I was a live DJ before I started producing. So I kind of had experience with crowds, a lot of experience playing in front of people before I even started producing. So I was always kind of producing music for my live shows. And I think indirectly, I think I started producing a lot of stuff that DJs wanted. And I didn't really necessarily mean to do that on purpose. But I think, you know, I think a lot of people start off producing and then they start DJing live after they're already sort of established producer. Then they're like, well, now I got to learn how to spin because then I got to go do this live. And I kind of did it the other way. And I think, you know, and I think what kind of happened was I got a sense of what goes over well for a crowd. And I think that was sort of an advantage I had when I started producing, because I think what really helped me a lot to build up a fan base was other DJs playing my music. And I think a lot of DJs, you know, frequent my SoundCloud and frequent my stuff because I think they've come to trust me as a source of somewhere to come get, you know, new tunes for their sets. And I think that's helped a lot. You know, that's a lot of advertising, you know, because I do get a lot of, hey, I heard, you know, a DJ drop your song here, I heard a DJ drop your song there, and then that eventually turned into, like, really big DJs dropping my song. You know, people start telling me, hey, I was at a Bass Nectar show, and he's dropping your music, and that was always, like, an amazing, like, flattering thing to hear. You know, I think I cater to DJs a little bit, which I wasn't necessarily preconceived, but now that what's happened has happened, it kind of appears to be that.
I think it's about time for me to hit these against the upside the head with some of that West Coast gangsta shit.
You hear the bass from the truck when I'm on the block.
Hold up.
West Coast is back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hold up.
West Coast is back.
California goes down to party.
What's up?
California goes down to party.
What's up?
Keep it rocking.
I'm California love.
Keep it rocking.
I'm California love.
Keep it rocking.
I'm California love.
Well, let me welcome everybody to the wild west.
Still California, courtesy of Wicked the Instigator.
Let's maybe back things up a bit so we can get the bigger picture. Are you originally from Nashville?
No, I'm from Owensboro, Kentucky. It's about 2 hours north of Nashville, so it's not like I crossed a great cultural divide when I moved to Nashville, but it's just I moved to Nashville in 98. So I've been here, I think, about 14 years, if my math is correct.
It is. and though it's Music City, USA, is that really true for hip-hop, which I imagine is your first love?
Yeah, I mean, it is. Nashville has everything. It's not all on the front burner the way the country slash, like, singer-songrighter stuff. That's all kind of, you see that first, and... But there is hip hop in Nashville, and there is electronic, and there's indie rock. Like, it's all there, and everybody's doing it, you know. So it's definitely Music City to the degree that almost you could throw a rock and you're gonna hit a producer or a studio engineer or a rapper or something, because everybody here is doing music in some shape or fashion, whether they're an actual musician or they're in the industry somehow. So, yeah, I mean, when you play a show here, if 200 people come to a show in Nashville, probably about 75% of them are also trying to do their own thing.
And that's got to be a lot of pressure. You're playing for the industry, you're playing for your peers. I imagine that steps everybody's game up.
Yeah, it is, and I like pressure. I'm very competitive, and so I like that. You know, I remember I told you at summer camp that Nashville to me kind of feels like the internet, because it's like it's oversaturated, but to me that's the oversaturation is a challenge to really break through. Like, you almost kind of got to go above and beyond a little bit to, like, break through the white noise of the oversaturation itself.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I also remember at that live show, you talked about getting panic attacks when you look at a turntable. I know you've moved on to more reliable digital equipment that doesn't skip when the bass really kicks. But tell me about first getting into turntablism, which I think, you know, really defines who you are as a DJ and a performer and a producer.
It's definitely part of the whole thing. Turntablism itself is what made me go by turntables and be a DJ. Like, I was attracted to, like, you know, Qbert and Mixmaster Mike and all that. That's what made me go to the store and get turntables. Essentially, I didn't even care about playing shows. Like, I mean, the first year or two I owned turntables, it was kind of like a glorified Xbox. It was just sitting in the basement and scratching. Like, I had no goals. I, you know, I didn't want to go. I didn't want to like mix records. I didn't want to go play a show. I just wanted to learn how to scratch. Like, I just wanted to learn how to make these awesome noises that these guys were making.
Mm-hmm.
The way things progressed, you know, and when I started getting electronic music, and I started getting more bass heavy music, you know, the bassier things got, the harder the turntables were having keeping up with what was going on. And,
sure.
You know, and it also went, you know, I used to, you know, years ago, I was only playing in Nashville. So I was playing in venues that I understood. I knew like what stages were hollow and what stages were solid. And, you know, once I started traveling, like everything kind of went out the window and I kind of felt like I was always wrestling with the turntables. Like it kind of got to a point to where turntables to me kind of felt like I was like navigating a rickety wooden ship through a storm.
And that's not going to free your mind up to be able to give your all to a performance.
No, and you know, I use the Newmark NS6 now, and I mean, there is absolutely no, I make no reservations about saying that I use it because it's easier. And I have kind of, you know, the whole paradigm shift from, you know, DJ to producer, like that's happened to me too. And it's also kind of happened to the entire scene. You know, used to DJs, like the DJs I liked, it wasn't like they were necessarily producing amazing albums. It's like they were taking everybody else's records and, like, you know, manipulating them, doing cool stuff with them live. But, you know, to me, it got to where I worked so hard in the studio. I spend hours and hours every day working, you know, on producing music. And there's two things I want when I go play a show. I want to have a good time. That's the fun time. I don't want that to be work anymore. I want my show to be fun. And two, I just want the equipment to work.
Yeah.
That's it. I just want shit to work and I want to have fun. I work my ass off in the studio. I don't necessarily want my live show to be a task. I don't want it to feel like I'm trying to like juggle and ride a unicycle at the same time anymore. I was a battle DJ for years. I've done all that. And now, you know, my shows now, I'm not trying to like show off or impress you or show, you know, I'm trying to give you a good fun show of my original music. So everything is, there's definitely been just a change in what it is I'm doing, but I'm definitely very happy to be from that school because, you know, it's good to have an understanding of all of it. You know, I'm glad that I started off on turntables. I'm glad that I know how to scratch and juggle and beat match and all that fun stuff, man. I mean, I love records. I mean, my record collection those are my prized possessions. And now instead of my records getting beat up and scratched and broken and beer spilled on them everywhere I go, they're sitting here at home like a little pristine comic book collection where I'm going to like keep them, you know?
Do you know who Old Dirty Bastard is?
It's going to be a 12-minute mini mix of a bunch of new, like, original, like, remixes and mashups and stuff. It's like Redman, Jay-Z, some DMX, Old Dirty Bastard, a lot of, you know, making a lot of Christmas music, mashup with a lot of Christmas music and like samples from movies and all that good stuff. So I'm excited to put that out. I think that's gonna be fun.
So I walk on over with my crystal, bitch, the tickets for the way you're pissed out. Dirty won't be having that in this house, cause bitch, I'll cripple your sound. Now that you heard my charming voice, you couldn't get another nigga. Your coochie won't get moist. If you wanna look good and not be bummy, girl, you better give me that money. I whispered in the air, you wanna be with me? You wanna look pretty though in my video? Old Dirty on my hat and I let you all know. Just dance
if you're caught up in the Holy Ghost trend.
If you stop, I'ma put them killer ants in your pants.
I'm the ODB, as you can see. FBI, don't do be watching me.
I don't want no problems, cause I put you down in the ground where you cannot be found.
I'm just dirt dog trying to make some money. So give me my streaks and give me my honey. Radios play this all day, every day. Recognize I'm a fool and you're loving me. None of you know, better look at me funny. You know my name now, give me my money.
Keep the change, you filthy animal.
I wonder, was it mashups that first got you into producing? That's, you know, partially what you've become known for, but was that your first foray into making music, or were you simply just producing regular tracks before the mashups really caught on?
It's kind of a weird progression. I'll try to not make it an hour ramble, but...
Don't worry about it.
I think the most concise version I can tell you, I started playing in bands when I was 13, so I've always been doing, you know, I started playing shows, like, in front of people, you know, when I was 13, 14 years old, and have been doing it ever since. So performing in front of people, even before I was a DJ, was the norm for me. I got my turntables when I was, like, 21. That's when I went out and bought turntables. And a couple years prior to that, I started recording music first on 4-track, on analog 4-track.
Okay.
And I liked, like, really weird, obscure stuff. Like, that was like a time in my life where I was listening to, like, Ween and, like, Frank Zappa, and I liked really weird shit. And I would just record, I have just tapes and tapes and tapes of 4-track tapes of me, like, programming a drum machine, and then I would play bass, and then I'd play guitar, and then I'd sample, like, a TV preacher or something weird, and just, like, go crazy with effects. And so I was making all this, like, super weird shit, and it was fun, but in a way, it was me trying to figure out what the hell I wanted to do.
Right.
And when I first got turntables, like I said, when I first got turntables, I just wanted to learn how to scratch. That kind of led to collecting records, you know, buying weird dollar records, going to garage sales and buying records. And then I got into the whole, like, sample-based making music, like, you know, kind of the way, like, you know, making hip-hop beats, kind of the way, like, DJ Premier does it, or the way, like, RZA used to do it for Wu-Tang. Like, you know,
sure.
I got really into, like, flipping, chopping up samples. And so, I was just wanting to make hip-hop even before I really made mashups. But I was always fascinated by acapellas. Acapellas are completely like crack cocaine to me.
Oh yeah.
I collect acapellas more hardcore than anything, still to this day. But mashups, I didn't know what mashups were. I owe all my mashup love and exposure to Z Trip, hands down. I think, like,
sure.
I think the second Bonnaroo, maybe, I don't know, 2002, I'm not sure exactly when Bonnaroo started.
About 2003, yeah, in there.
Yeah. I went to Bonnaroo mainly to see Mixmaster Mike because he was my hero, and I knew who Z-Trip was, and I was going to watch him too. But this is what happened. You know, they gave the DJs these little tents to play in, and not like the cool Bonnaroo. These were like real, like, Walmart $20 fucking tent. And
yeah,
the tents were kind of next to the big stage, so, like, the Allman Brothers would get done, and then they let a DJ. Well, I saw Mixmaster Mike, and as badass as he is, he had, like, 50 people standing around, and he just scratched for an hour. And, you know, I stood there with the other 49 people, like, nobody gets this. you know what I mean? I was like, everybody should be freaking out right now, because I was...
Yeah.
So then I see Z-Trip perform on the same tent. So some big band gets done. Z-Trip was the first, like, DJ performer, like, that I fell in love with, because as soon as the band got done, Z-Trip got on the mic, which Mixmaster Mike didn't really get on the microphone. Z-Trip mm-hmm. grabs the mic and he's like, "Yo, before everybody, you know, disperses off to go smoke a joint or eat a sandwich or whatever you're gonna do, my name's Z-Trip. The sounds you're hearing are coming from these records." And then he started mashing up like Grateful Dead and Snoop Dogg and Oasis and Janis Joplin and Led Zeppelin. And he had thousands of people just getting the fuck down to him. And he was in that same little shitty tent.
But just because he knew what the Bonnaroo fans were looking for, the Zeppelin, the Dead, the Joplin, he knew to be able to relate on that performer level. I imagine that's what sort of hooked you.
That, yeah, and I wasn't looking for it. Like, I was into scratch music, which was a niche thing. But I basically happened to see this DJ, instead of being like this niche thing, he was like this universal performer. And yeah, to see, instead of it being a DJ to where a few people that kind of get this are going to be enjoying it, this guy was like, I know how to get everybody in this room off right now. Like, everybody, and just the fact that they didn't have a stage, they didn't have any cool lighting, they didn't have shit, and Z-Trip took this little thing he had, and Z-Trip became an official Bonnaroo performer. And it was all just from him being a badass.
Yeah.
The other DJ, there was other scratch DJs. All the DJs seemed to be like, oh, this is what we're going to do. We're going to scratch for an hour and like 50 people are going to watch. Z-Trip was kind of like, y'all check this out. Jumped on the microphone, had that mic presence. Yeah, he knew where he was. He knew he was at Bonnaroo. So, yeah, like I said, he busted out Janis Joplin and Beatles and was mashing it up with all this hip-hop. He kept getting on the mic. He had everybody, like, light their lighters at the same time and blow them out at the same time. And it blindsided me because I wasn't even there to see Z-Trip. And that was, you know, long story short, Mixmaster Mike inspired me to, like, buy turntables. And Z-Trip inspired me to, like, go home and put a set together and get a gig. Like, that was what made me want to go public with DJing and with turntables, was seeing him. And it absolutely blew my mind. And the first mashup I ever made was, like, Tom Petty and Outkast. And that was back when we were, like, putting our music on MySpace. It's an ancient site that's somewhere in a museum right now.
Thankfully, I'm old enough to remember people editing their MySpace pages on the walls of caves next to the buffalo paintings.
But yeah, like, you know, I was putting my, like, hip-hop, small, whatever on MySpace. And when I made that Tom Petty and Outkast mashup and put it up on MySpace, that was the first, like, big buzz I ever got. And even my friends were calling me just like, yo, that's dope, and blah, blah, blah. And, like, just the reaction I got from my first mashup was really exciting, and it was really fun. And it kind of went from there. And the thing about it was, I grew up in a rock and roll household. My parents were all Beatles and Elvis. And when I first got into DJing and was really just like a hardcore hip hop head, I kind of felt like I had left a lot of my roots behind. Mm-hmm. And I think getting into mashups bridged all of a sudden, like, you know, because Tom Petty wasn't like, Tom Petty was something like I listened to as a kid. It wasn't like I Googled, like, what's a cool band or whatever. Like, right. that was my shit. And I felt like I was done with that. And that kind of made me realize that all this music I grew up on, all this experience I have playing guitar, playing in rock bands, listening to rock music, I'm like, man, all this shit is still game. It's still a part of what I'm doing. I don't have to leave all that behind. It's like I can bring all that shit with me from the Beatles, the Stones, even up to like Nirvana and Nine Inch Nails and the shit I was listening to in high school. It's like, man, all this shit can come in the pot. And that was really exciting to me, because even though hip hop is my favorite music, it wasn't really my childhood. It really wasn't, like, you know, part of my childhood and my upbringing. And it was really exciting that all this music that I thought I was done with actually got to be a part of what I was doing instead of separate from it.
But I'll be honest with you. You probably read it in Screw Up Your Life People magazine anyway. I used to smoke marijuana.
Marijuana. One for the money, yes sir, two for the show. A couple of years ago, on Headland and DeLow. What's the starter? Something good. Where me and my drove the martyr through the hood. Just trying to find that hook up. Now every day we looked up at the ceiling, watching ceiling fans go round, trying to catch that feeling off instrumentals. Had my pencil and plus my paper. We caught the 86 flies on your head to Decatur, writing rhymes, trying to find our spot off in that light. Light up in that spot, knowing that we can rock, doing the hole in the wall club. This shit give must stop, like freeze. We making the crowd move, but we not making no G's, and that's a no-no.
The Tom Petty Outcast mashup that started it all for Wicket the Instigator, right here on the Unz Podcast.
Speaking of Outkast, that leads us up to the Brothers of Chico Dusty, which was probably the first introduction many of your fans had to the Wicket sound. It was the same for me. Why Big Boy and the Black Keys? And when you are plotting something of that magnitude, multiple tracks, how do you visualize a long-form crossover like that? How do you know that you can make an entire album out of something like that?
Well, what a lot of people don't know about that album is what happened is I never intended on making that whole album. I made one mashup, the one with Shutterbug and Tighten Up. And it was basically just me hearing Tighten Up, just hearing that song and being like, man, that lick is so dope. Like, just as somebody who is like a sampler and like you're listening for shit, when you hear that shit, you're like, oh, I gotta sample that. Like, that, you know, Black Keys are like a hip-hop sampler's wet dream. Like, every little riff and progression they have is just like, oh, like, you know, that's, I'm going to grab that. But anyway, yeah. I only made the one single song, and you know, I made the beat out of Tighten Up, you know, I kind of made it into my own hip-hop instrumental, and it was really just some trial and error, and I found that Big Boy acapella, and I really loved the song Shutterbug, too, and I was just like, oh, man, this works. So I put out that one song, and, you know, I thought it was one and done, but what happened was Big Boy somehow heard it, and he tweeted my SoundCloud, he put it on his Facebook, and I was, you know, I still had a day job then. It was literally like a weird, like, 80s movie moment. I literally worked in a warehouse, like, which is the most, like, pre-music career job you could possibly have. You know, sure. I'm like throwing boxes around and getting yelled at. And all of a sudden, my friends are calling me and they're like, yo, dude, Big Boy is tweeting your shit. And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah. He's like, he tweeted it. He put it on Facebook and blah, 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 blah. And so, you know, that was an amazing day. And what happened was his management actually sent me a message. And it sent me a message in my SoundCloud, which is really weird. I was like, yo, I manage Big Boy. I want to talk to you. And I was kind of like, whatever. Like, I didn't believe it. And so this guy calls me. He's like, yo, we think you should make a whole album out of Black Keys and Big Boy. He's like, I manage Big Boy. And I was like, yeah, sure you do. That sounds great. Whoever, whatever 14-year-old kid I'm talking to. And I was like, I was like, I tell you what, you send me all of the studio acapellas from, you know, Big Boy's album, but send them to me in wave form. You know, I didn't believe that I was talking to a dude that managed Big Boy. Yeah. And I was basically like, if he sends me wave files of acapellas of Big Boy's entire album,
this might be legit.
It'll be real. Yeah. Because you can probably dig up most of the MP3s on the internet, but you're not going to dig up wave files. And, you know, only a couple of his acapellas were floating around anyway. Like, you know, he was like, yo, I want you to do the whole, Son of Chico Dusty album. He's like, I don't want you to just mash up any Big Boy with any Black Keys. He was like, I want you to do, you know, the Son of Chico Dusty album with the Brothers album. So anyway, the next day I checked my email and there was every single one of Big Boy's acapellas in wave form in my inbox. And I was like, holy shit. I was like, this is real. So this was like maybe like December 1st or 2nd in 2010. And I was like, when do you want to put this out? He was like, in 2 weeks. And I was like, oh, shit. So I spent day and night. So, yeah, I mean, I brought, you know, I made the whole album in like 2 weeks. And, but it was just like pure magic and excitement. So, like, it was really kind of like Big Boy's camp who came up with the idea for me to do the whole album, but they couldn't really be like vocally involved because nobody knew how the Black Keys were going to react.
Right.
Because they were the only ones on board. Here we all are plotting a Black Keys album and you know, they don't know, but you know, once the Black Keys caught wind of it, they posted it up too. So when I was making that album, I knew Big Boy was going to support it, and which that was because he was already kind of ready to go on it, and that was partially why it did so well. Like, as soon as I put it out, Big Boy started tweeting it. He put it on Facebook, and he put the album on Outkast.com, and it was actually Spin Magazine wrote an article about it, and Spin Magazine posted their article onto the Black Keys Facebook page, and the Black Keys just shared that article. So when the Black Keys posted it, they were actually posting the Spin Magazine article about the album. So yeah, and you know, and their management's here in Nashville, and I talked to their manager, and you know, some of the Black Keys people called their manager and was like, "Man, what the hell is this? What do we got to do?" And their manager was like, "Dude, run with it. It's cool." And you know, I was really excited that the Black Keys loved it. Like, there's really no better scenario for a mashup artist than to have both of the parties you're mashing up support what it is you've done. That kind of legitifies it, if that's a word.
it's twice as much work for you as a mashup artist. Usually when you remix something, you just gotta pray that the artist you're remixing either likes it or isn't gonna sue your ass. But yeah, with the mashup, you gotta get two people on board at least.
Yeah, and happened, and it was an amazing feeling. And you know and if you look at the Black Keys, I mean, the Black Keys are very, very down with hip-hop culture. I mean, they made the Black Rock album. You know, supposedly Dan Auerbach kind of DJs and spins on the side, little parties and stuff, and they work with Danger Mouse, and Danger Mouse is somebody that completely got to where he was through mashups, and that, so they're not some like old like rock band of like dads that work at Guitar Center that don't like Puff Daddy or whatever. Like, they're they're dudes that understand exactly, they understand hip-hop, they understand remixes and mashups, and they dug it, you know. They at least felt it was beneficial to support it, you know what I mean? Which was, yeah, very, very, very cool. Yeah, you know, because sometimes, you know, remixing, mashup, like you said, all that, it can be kind of controversial. People are like, "Oh, you're just stealing other people's shit," and blah, blah, blah. But when you mash up two artists and both artists are like, "Yo, we dig this, check it out," then that totally kind of validates me as being a legit artist. It's like, man, these people don't feel like I'm stealing their shit. These people dig what I'm doing.
Keep it player, watch some chiefs to play it safe. But check the resume, it's risky business in the A. And I've been witness to this history ever since the 10th grade. We went from rock and race to 10th phase. I twist my A-head to the side just for style. Or throw on the Gucci bucket with the fly, super fly. Wow, the Southern private known to shut it down. On it ain't so country though, nigga, this ain't no Goma pile. I'm Sergeant Slaughter, I keep my shit cooked to alter and alter to satisfy my people in Georgia and cross the water. And across the border, the essays are getting smarter. They got flour for tortillas and lettuce for enchiladas. If you follow, wink, wink, no doubt we don't speak in a blink. Them folks can have you sleeping in the clink. I'm shitting on niggas and peeing on the seat. It's that nigga, the B-I-D-B-O-I-O-U-T. Now party people in the club, it's time to cut a rug and throw the knees up in the sky just for the shots of buzz. I'm double fisted and you empty, you can grab a club. Boy, stop, I'm just playing, let me. Now party people in the club, it's time to cut a rug and throw the knees up in the sky just for the shots of buzz. I'm double fisted and you empty, you can grab a club. Boy, stop. Everybody buzzing around me.
leave. Could it be the way that the verses sounding came up on the ghetto boys and the underground king toys? I had a broom, call it pretty brown thing. Pink looked like root beer when the sun was shining. Known to keep a bad bitch, no niggas beside me. Index finger on the trigger case, niggas is clowning. Not to flex, but to protect my neck like the Wu-Tang. Self-preservation is the rule when you do aim. Or getting something more sinister, you gotta be the finisher. Make it so the doctors, they can't replenish him. Or bring him
Black Bug from the brothers of Chico Dusty, Wicked the Instigator's free Black Keys Big Boy mashup album. The next big release of yours that really was a game changer and I feel has really kicked off the second wave of your big moves, especially this year in 2012, was Grindhouse Bastards, which came out just about a year ago. First of all, why the obsession with Quentin Tarantino? What does Quentin Tarantino do for you?
I'm a huge fan of his movies. You know, I always have been. What's interesting about Quentin Tarantino is Quentin Tarantino is kind of like the mashup artist of movies to a degree. A lot of his, a lot of his lines and a lot of his ideas come from old, you know, kung fu movies, old Western movies, like a lot.
Sure.
A lot of Samuel Jackson lines, a lot, you know, like the, you know, and I will strike down upon thee, like that. That's from an old-ass kung fu movie. And, you know, he's, you know, Quentin Tarantino is very open about that. It's not a dirty secret. It's like he'll tell you, you know, he'll tell you himself, like, in an interview. Quentin Tarantino's kind of like, you know, a movie nerd the way I'm a music nerd. And he likes all these old movies kind of like the way I like all this old music. So he's kind of like a remixer to a degree, too. You know, and like if you look at his movie Death Proof, we've seen a lot of movies that are like Death Proof, but are just like kind of shitty. And Death Proof is like a shitty, awesome movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like he was watching some old shitty movie, and he was like, "Hey, this could be really cool if I remixed it."
Yeah,
that concept. And so I definitely, you know, I definitely dig that, because what Quentin Tarantino ultimately is he's a fan of movies, and I think ultimately I'm a fan of music, you know, almost before a producer or a performer. It's like I'm a fan, like I love it. And, you know, a lot of times I hear something and I'm like, man, I want to hear that my way. You know, I love that song. You know, I want to hear that song my way. And I kind of feel that's kind of how he is. He might like see a movie, see some old shit and be like, man, I want to do that my way. I kind of want to pump that full of steroids. So, yeah, man, I'm a huge Tarantino fan. And he's brilliant. Like, you know, he's got so much original content, too. Don't get me wrong. There's so much original content to his movies. You know, he's genius at writing a lot of the dialogue. And, you know, there's a lot of original content in my music, too. I think a lot of people don't get that. Like, if you look at a remix, like, people are like, all you do is remix. You're not, you know, you don't blah, blah, blah. And I'm like if you look at, like, at my remix, like, 5 on it, like, all that's practically original music. I just kind of am using the chorus from 5 on it kind of for the familiarity and kind of to set you up for the drop. So with Quentin Tarantino movies, I think it's a combo of kind of remixing and sampling, but then also a lot of original content. And I feel like that's definitely kind of how I make music. I use a lot of samples. I use a lot of other people's shit, but I'm using a whole lot of my own stuff too, you know, making a whole lot of stuff up from scratch.
I don't want to hear about no motherfucking ifs. All I want to hear from your ass is, you ain't got no problem, Jules. I'm on the motherfucker. Go back in there, chill them niggas out, and wait for the cavalry, which should be coming directly.
You ain't got no problem, Jules. I'm on the motherfucker. Go back in there and chill them niggas out, and wait for the wolf, who should be coming directly.
You sending the wolf?
No, you feel better, motherfucker?
Shit, Negro. That's all you had to say.
Automatic green weeds, got a daddy. 20 double bins up front, cause a frenzy. Automatic
duck, TV screens and wood, and we afraid. Ooh, we your lights, bold tires, swing and bang, tops drop, blade shop, fifth wheel just hanging, right? White tees, fitted hats, Jordans under tickets. The switch is sweet, cigarillos filled up with the stickies. The 15 spamming and the bass kick kicking. Cadillac, dough slamming on them foes tipping. We ain't tripping, just flipping. These haters dip when they see us, when they see us. Cause they could never beat us, best as a beast. I'm a G, that's a genius, best in just respect. My thug is main, it's the South, ain't nothing above it. And that's why I love it, why I love it.
And I think you really made a statement with your Weathermaker EP, because I bet people were assuming you did a certain kind of thing. And even though your remixes and mashups are wildly different, I wonder, did you consciously set out to craft original tunes that were nothing like nothing else in your catalog?
Yeah, and you know, with the Weathermaker EP, I wanted to make like original music, you know, get away a little bit from like remixes and stuff. And I also wanted to make like something sexy and something for people to just like listen to. You know, I don't play those tunes very much at shows. Like I said before, I'm usually producing for live shows. Like usually when I'm producing, I'm picturing, you know, this song in front of a crowd of rowdy people. That's usually how I'm producing. So I wanted to produce something for people to like sit back and vibe out to. And, you know, like you said, I want to be diverse. I don't want to attach myself to a certain sound, to a certain method, to a certain genre. I don't really want to attach myself to a certain anything other than it's going to be hip-hop music and it's going to be electronic music. I definitely want people to expect, you know, diversity from me. And so, yeah, I was like, man, I'm making all these, like, hard, face-melting remixes and shit, and it's going well. And I'm like, let's switch it up a little bit and make some, like, smooth, vibey original music. You know, I wanted people to understand that I'm not gonna be a one-trick pony.
And if people didn't already guess you had a great sense of humor, they figured it out with your Trap the Fuck Out remix of Bryan Adams' Everything I Do. And sure, it's hilarious, but I wonder if you're also making a statement about producers and even the fans trying to find the next sound and jumping to the next trend ceaselessly.
I mean, It was more just to be funny. Like I wasn't really trying to make a statement or diss anybody. It was really just supposed to be cartoonish and silly. I dig a lot of the trap music that's out now. I've even made some of it. I mean, I live in the Dirty South, which is the roots of kind of like the new kind of like trap style, like electronic music that's popular now. So, So I mean, it was really just me just goofing off and being silly. Like I really wasn't trying to make a statement. I was really just trying to be funny. I think, you know, I think 99% of people got the joke. There's definitely a couple people that was kind of like, hey, dog, why does this remix suck?
You got to be kidding me.
And I'm like, are you kidding me, dude? I was like, it's a minute long. And there's a goat in there somewhere. Like, figure it out, dude. Look into your heart.
Son, where'd you find this?
Take me as I am. Take my life. The child would give me the child. I would sacrifice. Don't be so sad. It's not worth fighting for. I can't help it. There's nothing I won't know.
Damn, girl. What the fuck is this shit?
I know it's true. Everything I do. Do it for you. Yeah.
What's another street vibe to the beat? What's another street vibe to the beat? Let me blow your mind. Let me blow your mind. What's another street vibe to the beat? What's another street vibe to the beat? What's another street vibe to the beat? Let me blow your mind. Let me blow your mind.
Weathermaker, the title track from Wicked the Instigator's free EP of originals. And before that, I don't even want to get into it.
You got to do Warped Tour, Forecastle, huge Insomniac events. What have you learned from this next level of live shows with bigger and bigger crowds? I mean, you mentioned that you like the pressure, you like those big stages, but is there something that, I mean, I guess, as an artist, you're always trying to advance your production and really craft the next level of composition. So I imagine as a performer as well, you're always able to take something away from each of your performances and really learn and progress.
Yeah, it's different. I like any show where I feel like when I can feel the energy from the crowd. And what's weird, the bigger shows, you know, like the bigger shows like Wakarusa and some of the festivals and stuff, like, because the stage is so big and the crowd's so big, I'm actually kind of like further away from the crowd, and that took a while for me to get used to. I remember like the couple like the first when I first kind of started playing bigger shows, I was like, were people feeling that? Because I was used to like people being, you know, playing in smaller, more packed places where people are literally like right in front of my face. Mm-hmm, you know, yeah. And I can tell. And so it was a weird adjustment, but I've actually come to enjoy it. I love both. You know, I love playing in front of huge crowds. It took me a minute to adjust because it is different. I mean, I'm used to little clubs where there's literally somebody standing right next to me just going, "You're killing it right now." You know, and yeah, there's none of that. Like when you play on a big stage, like a big festival kind of setting, you know, the front row is like, you know, maybe like 30 feet away from you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there is definitely some adjustment, but I definitely enjoy it. And, you know, I've had some great experiences playing at festivals. The bigger crowd, it just feels different, but now I'm becoming like more comfortable with it, and I definitely enjoy it. And I love playing the smaller, like packed out shows too, the more intimate shows, you know, and I think everybody kind of likes those better to a degree, even, you know, the audience members. I think, you know, if you were going to see your favorite band or DJ or whatever, you'd almost prefer to be at like 200 people in some little bitty place. But I also like the idea of the big grandiose shows, like, you know, like what people like Pretty Lights and Bass Nectar are doing with their stage production. I love all that. I mean, the first show I got to, we threw a show in Nashville where we brought out lasers and lights, and we had like techs running it, and we're, you know, coordinating like, this is, you know, my very first song, this is what the intro's like, and then, you know, I want it to be all purple right now, and then when it drops, we're gonna like blah, I'll turn all this shit on. And I loved it. I loved like trying to like coordinate a bigger scale show, and you know, I definitely look forward to doing more of that. So you know, I like it all. Like, I like the small intimate shows, but, you know, I'm ready to do a big grand production of my own, and hopefully something that I'm going to be doing more and more in the future.
And you actually get to experience that dichotomy coming up here shortly. You're playing the UNCE's third anniversary party in San Francisco on the 21st at 1015 Folsom. And then 10 days later, you've got Lights All Night in Dallas to ring in the new year. Do you have anything special in store for your fans? And can people expect something a little different from the big show and the smaller, more intimate show?
You know, honestly, there's not a lot of difference. I've been trying to do mainly original music at my shows now, which is something has been a goal of mine, because I have enough content to do all original shows, but I'm trying to get to where I have the right content to do all original shows. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. like, because ultimately I'm wanting to do the best set I can. You know, some of the smaller shows, I play all my hard stuff. I play all like the bangers and everything. A lot of times at small shows, it feels a little bit more like a party. Usually at the end of my set, I'll kind of go up more off into like hip hop land and mashup land. And, you know, it's kind of like the smaller shows, it's kind of like I do my thing where I come out and I kick everybody in the face repeatedly for about an hour. But then I usually kind of like get funky and fun. And a lot of times at the bigger shows, I have a shorter set time. So sure. It's like I'll kind of go out there and just kind of just throw hammers for an hour and then be done with it, to where if I'm playing 2 hours or 2.5 hours in a smaller place, there's more freedom to kind of like turn some corners and do some different stuff. But honestly, the meat and potatoes in my set are the same no matter what the setting. It's you know, me trying to showcase what I think is my best stuff. And you know, I have you know, I used to release everything I made as soon as I made it, and I've learned how to hold back a little bit. So now when you see me play, you're going to hear some unreleased stuff of mine, which I think is really fun. Because like I said, I used to not be able to hold back. The second I got done with something, it was on SoundCloud. And now it's like, it's kind of fun after a show to have somebody want, they're like, yeah, that LL Cool J remix you played, like, when's that coming out? And I'm just like, maybe never. So you'll have to come keep seeing me live if you want to hear that. So it's like, it's definitely fun to have some unreleased bangers to play at shows, which is something I've never had the willpower and self-control to do, but I'm learning how to do that.
That's incredible. Andrew Owsley, Wicket the Instigator, thank you so much for being on the UNCE podcast, and we're looking forward to celebrating our third anniversary with you.
Absolutely. I appreciate all y'all's continued support, man.
That's going to do it for this week's special hour-long episode. Special thanks go to Heath Bomar with APA Nashville, John Romero with Vector Management, and of course, my guest, Wicket the Instigator. A Very Wicket Christmas is available for free download now through SoundCloud and Facebook. And Wicket's going to be in California all week. He'll be at Central Social Aid and Pleasure Club in Santa Monica tonight, then up in Sebastopol at Hop Monk Tavern supporting Minnesota tomorrow night. And he closes out the week at the UNCE's third anniversary party at 1015 Folsom in San Francisco on Friday, December 21st. That's this Friday. He joins Freak Nasty, Sleepyhead, Symbionic, Akara, and more. Come celebrate our third anniversary, the end of the world, the beginning of the world, whatever you want. More details at ecpresents.com. The UNCE is now selling fan club tickets for Elliot Litt. Catch him on December 21st at Trees in Dallas, the 22nd at Cafe Nova in Oklahoma City, and then he'll be headlining the Bass Drop at the Portage Theater in Chicago on New Year's Eve. We've also got tickets for the Beginning of the World party at the Parish in Austin this Friday. And don't forget about Infrasound in Minneapolis, Feed Me, Zomboy, Mount Eden, Andralian, Eskimo, Welder, Spankalicious, and more, December 30th and 31st. Go to tickets.theunce.com to set yourself up. Please visit theunce.com for news, artist profiles, tour dates, and now tickets to some of the biggest shows across the electronic music spectrum. And go ahead and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Write us a review, tell us what you think of the show.
If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about the program, you'd like to be a guest on the Unz podcast, or you'd like to sponsor an episode, contact me at anand@theunz.com. That's A-N-A-N-D at theunz.com. Join the conversation at the Unz podcast on Twitter. We'll catch you next week.